This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hey, it's Lance, your host of yesterday's concert. Before we get this episode started, I want to take 25 seconds to tell you about my other show, Jam Journals. Jam Journals is a podcast that takes you on a journey through music history, featuring live performances from some of the most iconic concerts of all time. Each episode recounts a different concert experience through a dramatic narrative that brings the memories to life with vivid detail and emotion. Join us as we take a trip down memory lane of some of the most unforgettable concerts in recent history. Jam Journals is available everywhere you get podcasts. Yesterday's Concert is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network.
To challenge oneself is very important. I don't know about challenging other people. There's only so far you can go if your whole bent is to incite or challenge other people. I think you'll do that anyway if you challenge yourself in a good way, creatively. We spend our lives in this zone. It's what we strive towards, this. And what we like to be and often how we like to see ourselves is this challenging, dark force of nature. But just, you know, find a body of water, have a Portuguese lager, listen to some Flaco Jimenez or something like that.
Welcome to Yesterday's Concert, a podcast that celebrates live music. My name is Lance Ingram, and in this episode we talk to Angus Rogers, frontman of Opus Kink. We discuss the role of art in the world, poetry versus songwriting, and the band's latest release, My Eyes, Brother. Grab your earplugs as we unravel artist authenticity and integrity. So I'm here with Angus Rogers, frontman for Opus Kink, killer band. Angus, how you doing today, man?
I'm well. How are you, Lance?
I'm doing well. Before we started recording, we had quite the dour conversation about our two countries and the situations that they're in. But maybe this will be a lively conversation. We'll see where this goes, man.
We'll do our best, yeah.
We will. So as is tradition on the show, we like to start with some icebreakers. So my first one, it's a lighthearted one. Where's your favorite place to get a pint?
There's two favorite places to get a pint. Okay. The twain do not often meet. The first one is any good Irish bar in London for a pint of Guinness, which is one of life's redeeming features, I think.
I agree.
Which is the more often attended venue. But then sometimes, depending on where you are, there's a body of water nearby. If it's more than 18 degrees Celsius outside, then it'll be some kind of Portuguese lager by a river or by the sea.
That sounds lovely.
You know, and I juggle them. I can't choose between them. They have their own individual magic.
That sounds absolutely lovely right now. Like, after this is over, we're going to lift our spirits and we're going to meet somewhere by the water and have that pint. That's what we're going to do to lift our spirits. Okay.
No knives and guns.
Yes, exactly. So second question. I know I was reading about you guys and I read that Sons of Kemet is one of your influences, and I got to see them live last year, and it was one of the most transcendent shows I've ever seen. Yeah. So I'd love to hear, what do you think would be a cool song of yours, of Opus Kink, for them to sit in on?
What, to play on, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe one of the more frantic ones, like Wild Bill, or I Love You Baby. I don't know. I mean, we took influence from that whole, when we started this band, that was a big sounding point, was the London jazz thing. And I think it's the kind of the rhythm section interplay, and that Sons of Kemet and Ezra Collective and groups like that, they've got a lot of kind of grime or dub influence in the rhythm section rather than like overtly around and about, which we liked, you know, and kind of Latin things as well. But yeah, if I mean, I say I'd love to play with them, but it would just kind of end, it would be overwhelming and then a bit boring because I just can't play like that. So I'd rather watch them. Or maybe they can do a fucking tribute album to us.
That's a better idea. That's, they definitely should get on that. They should definitely do a tribute album to you guys. Okay.
Cowards, slackers.
So third question. Leonard Cohen, I know you're a fan of his. What's one of the songs that he wrote, that he put out, that you would love to steal from his discography and put your name on it?
In terms of Opus Kink, I always wanted us to do a version of First We Take Manhattan, or anything from I'm Your Man. But as me, myself, an incalculable amount of moments or songs that I wish I'd written, and I'm sure I emulate them very badly often enough. But to choose one, I've been listening to Coming Back to You off Various Positions a lot recently, which is, the older I get and the more jaded or experienced, depending on which one you want to talk about that day, absolute simplicity and a single emotional... just one emotional pass, you know, you don't have to run the full gauntlet of everything and simplicity. But yeah, so many.
Lame. Yeah, that's great.
My man.
Yeah. So next question. I've heard that I have not been able to see you guys live yet, and we'll talk about that a little later, but I've heard you have big frontman energy, to use a little bit of a slang.
Yeah.
What is, in your opinion, what do you think your secret weapon as a frontman is?
I think any front person's or any physical performer's secret arsenal is the happy marriage between a desperate desire to be perceived and to impress people, and also a proclivity to not really care how that happens, and to try a bit of everything. Which is not something that I've mastered, but I think those two wolves fucking inside me give rise to, well, you know, that BFE quote that someone said. But yeah, the not giving a shit and not giving a shit and trying to reconcile those two. But it's just having fun and not taking it too seriously. But then again, it's as serious as your life, and I'm just going to disclaim myself for the rest of this conversation, clearly.
Well, I mean, but that's interesting, though, because it is like your art and the lyrics that you provide to the music are rather serious. They're heavy lyrics. Like you really start to digest them, and you're like, oh my God, this is heavy stuff. And so, I mean, that's, what's the balance then of not taking yourself too seriously when you're singing these incredibly heavy words?
I mean, you can go very deep on this one because it kind of...
Well, let's do it.
Has its roots in more of a life philosophy, which I'm not saying is what our music is, because largely our music is fun and experiment in sound and community rather than any kind of attempt at a masterwork. But, you know, that Trojan horse of the lyrics being snuck in under a nice patina of... music or artwork or whatever, it's both as serious and as unserious as being alive is, or as the world is. It depends on how you're thinking on that day, or what you've read, or, you know, what you've experienced recently. It's just music and lyrics are nothing, are dust in the air, but then also that people make lives from them. So there's nowhere to land between that, and I'm happy to flip between the two. And there's a satisfaction in delivering lyrics that might be unpleasant or slightly more difficult to digest or understand beneath this veneer of pop music. It's a fun idea.
Well, so, I mean, when you're writing, are you writing for yourself, or is it with the listener in mind? Are you trying to produce something that people will find meaning in, or is it just an expression for you to get something off your chest?
Maybe neither. Maybe more so that they, meaning or lack of meaning becomes apparent afterwards a lot of the time, I find, or I kind of attach a, if someone asks me a year later, I'll attach a meaning to it then, because I've had time to think about it, digest my own inane thoughts. But I think I write for myself as a listener rather than myself or the listener. You try and write something that you would want to listen to. And God knows if I would want to listen to our music if I wasn't in this band. You'd hope so, but you can never be sure. But first port of call and energy, whether the words sound good with the music, need something guttural or something pathetic, or and then the lyrics come after that. And then it's a work in progress, and you might scrap something. Mm-hmm. I feel strangely ill-equipped to answer the question, but I'm happy to keep answering them.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of sounds like to me, like to you, it's more important to be a vessel for the words, and that you'll find meaning in them later. You'll let the listener interpret their own like life application to them. But to me, it just seems like you're more concerned with the artistic perspective of putting pen to paper, even though I know you type your poetry and things like that.
Yeah, it is. It's flexing a muscle. It is exercise to pen to paper, finger to keyboard. But it is important to me and to lots of people who write lyrics, whether their lyrics appear serious, quote unquote, or not. But it's not something that I've found that it's not something you can have a fixed process with, or this is why and when I write lyrics or music or poetry. And I think that unfolding of apparent meaning or the changing of the substance of something is part of the allure.
So I'm sure you've been asked this before, like what kind of is your writing process then? Are you waiting for lightning to strike, or do you seek inspiration?
I don't wait for lightning to strike, because usually the final cut of a lyric that will end up on a record is rushed, because I've put it off until the last minute and then I need to write it in the studio. Mm-hmm. But it's usually a method of kind of vomit, spewing as much out as possible and then playing with it later. But again, I couldn't tell you a single way that these things come about, because the pace of life changes and the way that you feel about how you do it changes all the time. So it's best not to land on something, I don't think. As long as they come at some point. And sometimes you realize that quick is good, or gestation is good, each individual project. So bring on the next miserable, mind-boggling confusion as to how lyrics come about. I have that one under my belt.
Do you ever, it seems like you're pretty deadline driven in the sense that like you got to get something done, so you put something out there. Do you ever look back and think, I wish I had more time with it, or is it, if I had spent more time with it, I would have ruined what it was because it was so in the moment?
Well, both. I think there's things that I'd like to change, or I would have done better, or live versions of songs that we put out 3 years ago that are much better now. I also think that there are some songs that we play now that went too far, but fuck it, just put the next thing out. Take those lessons and make something new of it. There's nothing to be gained in the what ifs, I don't think.
Well, I know you have a book of collected poems, and I was in another interview, you were talking about kind of songwriting versus poetry writing. And I want you to expand on a statement that you said. You said a good poem doesn't necessarily make a good song.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that?
A lot of the time, poetry that people sing, Leonard Cohen, again, he's done that a few times and put poems to music, but even still, he's had to change them, change the register or add some rhyme. I mean, I'm happy to stand corrected in the future, but poetry as music. I think it's more the assumption that it will work. People assume, well, if you write lyrics, that's poetry, and if you write poetry, then you're going to be good at writing lyrics. But the most stunning songs that I've ever, a lot of my favorite songs, the gravity of one line and where it's placed, or the utter simplicity or repetition, which are all things that can be utilized in poetry. But, you know, pop music and its sensibilities is a completely different essence to poetry. And in the same way, your favorite, you know, a lot of the time, if you read Bob Dylan lyrics, you know, from those early mid 60s times, you see them on the page and you just think, shut the fuck up, man. You know, it's just this kind of, it's like reading Tarantula, his book. It's yeah. Just get over yourself, mate. But yeah. Then he sings it with that air that he had or has. So they don't always translate. But I kind of ate my words after the interview that you're talking about, because the time constraints, I was like, shit, well, I'm exhausted and I can't grasp anything right now. So then I'll go back to a poem and lift a line. So, you know, I'm full of shit, basically.
But I mean, you're making it, there is a differentiation between the two that you're talking about. Because while you're talking about that, I'm thinking about like Jim Morrison, when he did that album of poetry where he just recited poetry and he listened to music, or there was music playing behind him.
Yeah.
And as a teenager, I was like, oh, this is so heady and deep. But now as an adult, I'm kind of looking back on it, I'm like, that's really pretentious. Like, it is kind of pretentious.
Yeah, yeah. You've got to run that risk, really. And that sounds like a poetry record rather than a poems as songs.
Yeah.
Spoken word over music, which is pretentious.
Yeah.
But somebody has to do it. And you lay it out for the world to see and to judge. And some people will, you know, die on the hill of that record, and other people will dismiss it as pretentious dog shite, which it may well.
In your opinion, is it pretentious to say, if you're a songwriter, to call yourself a poet?
You can call yourself what you like. I think the label of poet is not something to be earned.
Hmm.
The label of songwriter is not something to be earned. If you practice that discipline, then that's what you are. I think in lots of ways it's empowering to call yourself these things, as long as you take it with the necessary pinch of salt and don't start getting too lofty about yourself. But, you know, as an affirmation, I write songs, or I write poems, or sins, not tragedies, then do it. I think we all need to be more. People are often very shy or over-humble about how they see themselves as a creative person. Life's too short to not call yourself the best harpsichord player in your weight or whatever.
So, I mean, if somebody, like you were saying, if somebody's shy about calling themselves that, you're more of the mindset that if you're producing art, you should be sharing it in some fashion. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. To a certain extent, like, if you feel like it, then you are, whatever that may be. I think it's bad to gatekeep things, really. Many things are shit and a lot of people are unbearable, but we don't have to set those goalposts up before they've even started being shit and unbearable. Yeah, so just say it loud and proud. If you write poems, you're a poet. If you write songs, you're a songwriter, you know?
Well, I mean, and going back to the conversation we had before we started recording about just the bleakness of our state of the world, more art is definitely not going to hurt that. Like, it's definitely not going to push the needle in the wrong direction. I mean, if anything,
it's not necessarily going to help it either, but I think on a personal micro level, it's definitely not going to hurt you individually.
So you don't think that more art in the world would be beneficial?
I mean, there's so much of everything. When we say more, you know, adding one more drop to the heaving ocean, I think a call to arms for more art, because more art now is, that would have meant a different thing 50-100 years ago, but more art in the world, you know, it's like deviant art and SoundCloud, and you'd have to wade through, you'd be a lot more hard pressed to pick out the good stuff, but more good art would be great on a global level, because good or bad doesn't come into it on a personal level, really.
On a personal level for you, is songwriting or poetry writing, is that cathartic for you? I mean, is that a way of expressing yourself?
It becomes more and more so the longer I do it. I was thinking this earlier. I remember not really feeling like that. And people say, you know, art is my medicine and music is my therapy. And I hate to say it, but I used to kind of think, fuck off, or which is probably a defense mechanism for me not really understanding that. But also because I've had a very happy upbringing and I, you know, very lucky in my early life. So, but as life goes on, the emptiness reveals itself. It does become, it's more stark. It appears more vital to do what I do for myself, which is something I'm enjoying, despite being a bit of a natural self-satisfied cynic. I'm very happy to feel that these things do me good now, and that I've become kind of an inalienable part of how I go about my life. And there's that carries with it, like we were just talking about. I say that and I feel kind of slightly sheepish or embarrassed about it, which is the same as someone saying, oh, I write poetry, but I don't know whether to call myself a poet. But yeah, creating things is has now become part of my makeup and I require it. So, and that's just how it is, man.
Well, going back to kind of what you said a second ago, what was the reason, what was the defense mechanism that you were popping up? Like, why were you afraid in those early days of producing or letting it be cathartic?
I don't think I was afraid, or I didn't know I was. I just thought it was like music was cool, or you know, art was like cool, something to do. You know, I held it in high regard. I kind of was often ignorant to the centrality of it, to people's kind of mental health or general balance of their lives. It was just another thing that I liked to do. And there was an element of scorn in how I felt about it, which I'm, you know, not proud of, but it was, you know, as a teenager, scornful teenager. But I, you know, maybe I was afraid, but I think that laxening, is that a fucking word? I need to grow
It
up.
can be right now.
Yeah. Loosening of my defenses can only be a good thing now, I think.
Well, what spurred that loosening? Was it just age and maturity?
Yeah, I think it's a certain amount of experience and the humility that comes from that, and a vague perception of what is worth doing. Just lessons learned from mistakes and realizing what makes you feel good and what makes you feel like a crock of shit, which most things do. So it becomes much more apparent the things that do make you feel good, the things that spur you onwards, even a touch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I want to go back to what you said earlier too. You said you had a fairly happy upbringing, and you know, when I read the lyrics, especially, you write some dark stuff, man. You write some heavy stuff, and you know, I
Yeah.
think there's a lot of beauty in it as well. So where is that coming from? Where are you tapping into to find that source?
I don't know. It's always been there. I was a very morbid child. The things that I read and the things that I obsessed over.
Like what kind of stuff? What were you into?
I was just into a lot of, you know, like dark, when I was young, when I was a child, you know, kind of the darker aspects of fairy tales. You know, I was always drawn to the witches and the devils and all that kind of thing. And then from quite a young age, kind of like a morbid fascination with, I mean, largely with death, a fascination with that, even before I understood or was actually afraid of it. Yeah, it's kind of like sexy in some way. And it terrified me and therefore interested me, and still does. But yeah, I mean, if there's no blame to be placed on my family or anything like that, as far as I'm aware, because as I said, my upbringing was stellar. I've been very lucky. But despite that, the dark tide kept lapping, and I'm glad, you know, because then the Brothers Grimm and all of that gave way to Samuel Beckett, and now today to, you know, writers like Ottessa Moshfeghi. And I don't know, I think there's underneath the stone, what's under the stone is a driving, it's quite an urgent thing in my life. And underbelly, not necessarily of society at large, but what's on the underbelly of my own mind or my own understanding of life. Question everything, and you know, the filth and the worms are, you might as well roll them out into the light. And sometimes it does me dirty and I feel a bit lost in it. Put myself in that position. So there you go.
I mean, do you think it was because you had such a fortunate upbringing, do you think it was a form of rebellion, or do you think it was more a search for the realness in life? Because I mean, you know, like your song 118, like it's a reference to Ecclesiastes 118, or at least you referenced it in the song. And yeah. I mean, I've read the book of Ecclesiastes, and a lot of what you're saying kind of resonates with that book as well. Like, I mean, they, you know, that kind of the realness of like, everything will wither away. Nothing really matters. And so, I mean, which do you think it was? Was it just kind of the search for realness that you was so sexy and attractive to you?
I think it was, I mean, as I said before with how I thought about art, I think it was maybe it was just an aesthetic. It seemed attractive and I was drawn to it. And also the, you know, from ancient pagan cults to Edgar Allan Poe and Aleister Crowley, and then to, you know, goth and emo. There was always a sense of you know something that other people don't, you know, to be different, to be special, and to be kind of misunderstood and feared, but in like a cool, sexy way. It doesn't feel particularly rebellious against my life. I think it's rebellious against in a base sense rather than a, you know, punk sense. I think it's rebellion against the norm of things we're fed, you know, which is the most tired concept in the world. But as a young adult or as a teenager or even a child, you do, if you start to feel that early on, then it becomes part of your misshapen identity, for better or worse.
But I mean, isn't that the basis of every good art, is that it's challenging, at least the listener or the observer, it challenges you in some way. I mean, that's, in my opinion, music is the highest form of art. And I think about all the things that have challenged the status quo. I mean, look at Elvis. I mean, the way he challenged the status quo revolutionized music and moved it forward. So, I mean, don't you think it's important that we challenge art?
I think, yes, and challenging art is a driving force. But I also love lots of kind of really bad, vacuous pop or country music or pop country and things like that. And I don't know why, you know, and then these sugar-coated chord progressions. But then I think I like them because it's as a breather or a garnish to the things that challenge you. But yeah, to challenge oneself is very important. I don't know about challenging other people. There's only so far you can go if your whole bent is to, you know, incite or challenge other people. I think you'll do that anyway if you challenge yourself in a good way, creatively. We do try to do that ourselves. And the music that often inspires us and lots of other people is music that seems more daring or more base or with fewer morals, with a stripping away of things.
I mean, it's funny you mentioned the pop country. I don't believe in guilty pleasures necessarily. But I will say that, like Brad Paisley, I don't know if you're familiar with him.
A few songs.
Yeah, I mean, that to me is like a guilty pleasure because I don't like to admit that I like it. But, you know, during the summer when it's hot and I can sit by the pool with a cold beverage, you know, that's, I'm probably going to put on some Brad Paisley. But I think it's almost kind of like you were saying, it's a form of escapism because I do listen to something heavier like Opus Kink, where I start digesting the words or I start digesting the value of the art, and it challenges me and it makes me think. And then
you need some time.
You got to refresh.
We'll spend our lives in this zone. It's what we strive towards, this, and what we like to be and often how we like to see ourselves is this challenging, dark force of nature. But geez, you know, find a body of water.
Yeah.
Have a Portuguese lager, listen to some Flaco Jimenez or something like that.
Well, so I mean, is that like, take a song like Mosquito, is that kind of the basis for adding the funk and the more danceable like aspects to it? Is to, I mean, I know that's probably just y'all wanted to do something funky, but like, does that kind of counteract, like we're talking about the heavier lyrics, to make it more attractive to the listener, more accessible to you? Get the heavy stuff, but you also get the escapism as well.
Yeah, totally. From the start, or at the start, that was a kind of a base tenet of what we thought we were trying to do, which is is to have music that's fun and you know, music that's, let the music be the sex and the lyrics be the death and the shame and all of that kind of thing, because why not parade these awful things about ourselves or how we feel about the world in a big frilly dress, or, you know, six white boys trying to do James Brown or whatever. There's a bit more levity to it in that way. I mean, don't get me wrong, I like miserable music with miserable lyrics.
I get it.
It's largely what I listen to. And I write music like that outside of this project. But yeah, that's what Opus Kink is, as far as I can gather. Is the music is the sex, and the lyrics are the other side of things.
I went back and I listened from the first single to your current EP, Children, which will not be your current EP by the time this comes out. And I mean, you definitely start more on the funky danceable side, but it seems like you're leaning more towards like the heavier music, especially with the Children EP. Is that kind of just a natural progression of the band?
I think so. With this record, this is a heavy record and lots of it's very guitar based, which kind of moved on from a little bit already with the next batch of things that we're writing. But as a snapshot of what we were doing, we'd started to tour more than ever and cut our teeth on the road, and things are heavy. And we wrote quickly, and we had lots of frustrations and desires to get out. So I think that the music suited the time. But it's not a linear progression. You should have heard the shit that we were doing before those first singles. You know, say that was more kind of jazzy and funky. It's quite well documented, but we thought we were going to be a jazz band, which when we started this, we were like, oh, we're going to do kind of Latin, African, white boy music. And we couldn't do it, obviously, because we are in a relative inability at the instruments. So there's some things that have not changed at all and some things that are completely different. But yeah, I think that this record being heavy is not really a sign that the next one's going to be heavier or the same. Mm-hmm. It's just what happened at the time.
You know, you're talking about the restraints of pre those early singles. What are the restraints now that are keeping you from expanding on what you want to do?
Money. Mm. Record labels. We've got this record and a tour, and you know, hopefully you talk to people, but that side of things slows up and speeds down at will, and you know, there's many dead ends, and in many ways you kind of ignore it if you know what's best for you, or rather than ignore it, let it occupy a small space in your mind. But you know, we get called all these lovely things by people when we go on tour and, you know, grow this cult thing, but it's still clearly slightly too cult for anyone to pick us up and give us 50 grand to go away and really have time to make a record. But we'd make them in any time and with any resources that we could. So that's almost neither here nor there. Line our pockets, industry, please.
Hear his plea. That's, you do have a new EP coming out this Friday at the time of this recording. My Eyes Brother, we haven't really talked about it at all. So let's just talk about it real quick. When did y'all record this? When was this done?
We did this in, I think it was December, in the countryside in Devon, in southwest of England. We recorded it very quickly, 2 days. We recorded everything live. There are a few overdubs, but all the drums and the bass and most of the guitar and the vocals is the second or third take or whatever. We hadn't worked like that before. We've had a problem with recording, with not being able to match the live energy. And I think we're a live band in many regards. But we wanted to become more of have our own stamp in the studio. I think again, for the time and what we were trying to do and feeling, I think it's a good representation of that. But it's very raw and very live. And it was mixed and mastered very quickly. I did all the artwork for everything and dashed it out. It's been a very, it's not rushed because things happen when they're needed to, but it's a DIY record. It feels like so long ago now, as all projects do. And I'm looking forward to hearing what people think about it, you know, and I think it will be, as is often the way with us, more established magazines and, you know, all the heads will be a bit meh about it. And then we'll have some blessed, amazing journalist doing a blog in Italy or Estonia or something, writing a 2,000-word essay on why it's the best thing they've ever heard, which is what really matters, of course.
It is all that matters.
But I shouldn't be so cynical, because you never know. Maybe people will love it.
Well, I mean, if it's anything like your past work, it'll be fantastic. And I don't say that just to blow air up your skirt, but I really do believe that. So, I mean, did you guys come in with the songs done and ready to be recorded?
There were, I think, 4 out of 5 of them, 5 out of 6, I can't remember how many are on the record now, were pretty much done. There were still tweaks done while we played through them on the first day. One of the songs, which has come out today, actually, called Piping Angels, that was written completely in the studio from a very few vague ideas. But before that, the songs were written very quickly at the end of last summer, because we were told that there were all these big, buzzy eyes on us and we needed to get everything out. And so we wrote this record out of nowhere, demoed it before we finished anything. And then suddenly we were in the studio, which is quite a fun way to work.
Yeah.
We'll be up to trying other ways of doing it, but may we never find a perfect method.
Yeah.
Yeah, it all happened very quickly, and the songs were, they hadn't been gestating for very long.
So there was no like road testing of the songs? Like, you didn't perform these songs live to see how they were performed?
Some of them we played in a tour that we did just before going into the studio, but they were still kind of like, you know, couldn't quite remember all the lyrics, and mm-hmm. they were a bit kind of long and overblown. But you need to do that sometimes to know how a yep. song, all the time actually. If you play it live, then there's no point doing anything until you've tested it, at least in a room with each other, I think, for our music anyway. It was a smash and grab, basically.
So as we kind of start to wrap up, I had one more icebreaker that I wanted to ask you, and I'm glad I get to wait till the end to ask this one.
Oh, yeah.
So I was in reading about you and reading some interviews with you, I've read that, and I'm not going to ask you the question, but you hate it when people ask you what the meaning of the band name is, that you've gotten it so frequently that you've just started to make up stories about how the band name came into practice.
Yeah.
I was wondering, do you have a favorite story that you've told somebody about how the band name came in?
I mean, I did so many. I think there was one particular summer or year that I kind of looked at people just in amazement when they would come in with that as the first question.
Yeah.
Like, for starters, it's just like, you clearly have no interest in this. This is like,
yeah.
Alexa, write me some fucking interview questions. I think I did, there was, but then also my replies were equally overblown and self-satisfied, or rather, you know, conversely overblown and self-satisfied. I think there was one about, because our alternative name within ourselves is, you know, when you go to a green room or like a toilet in a venue and everyone's written their band name on the walls,
mm-hmm.
you get the urge to do that when you've had a few whatevers, but it also makes you slightly cringe, and we just end up writing hopeless cunts on the wall, which is kind of like the affectionate colloquial name for this band. And I think that came from when I told someone smarmily, told a poor interviewer that I was in a bordello in Spain or something and playing cards and had a fight, and someone called me a hopeless cunt in a thick accent. But you know, I kind of probably write those off now because I could just grow up and be polite or just ask the next question, you know. But I did do a fair few, so listeners, they are available out there to peruse.
Oh, and they are well worth the read. I mean, that's, I was thinking there was another one you were asked, something about like a memorable live performance or something like that, and you answered like one of the horny boys was like out sick or something, so you guys constructed a robot to play in his place, and then the robot was better than him, and he ended up.
We were filming something in a warehouse that we used to rehearse in Brighton, and our trumpet player at the time couldn't come, so we had the audio recorded already, and we were just going to kind of play along to it. I don't know what that project was. We did lots of those kind of harebrained, ill-advised projects back in the day, but he couldn't make it, so we're like, well, fuck it, we'll just make him. I think there was kind of like the mic stand, a hat, a broom and a trumpet with lots of gaffer tape. But it being an inanimate object, it wasn't in fact a better trumpet player.
Yeah.
But you know, there's no smoke without fire. In every lie, there's a seed of truth.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, I did love the finale, the grand finale of that story, where it was they had to duke it out, and actually your original trumpet player had to prove his worth and beat Robot to be back in the band.
And some kind of Caesarean thumbs up, thumbs down situation.
And now I'm very disappointed to hear that that's only partially true. I'm distraught over this.
I mean, there's time for that to become totally true. With we could get an AI fucking trumpet player.
Very exactly. Shortly. That's on the docket for the next.
And an AI singer while you're at it. That would be easier.
It would be. And you wouldn't have to go so much through emotional distress.
No, I wouldn't get there. Go through this. All this hardship as a singer. Poor me. Poor little artist boy.
Well, I mean, maybe that's what AI stands for, is like artist interpretation or something like that.
Well, yeah, you could think that. It's up to interpretation, though.
There it is. So, well, Angus, man, it's been a pleasure. I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you, man. Thank you so much for sharing today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Lance Ingram, and this is Yesterday's Concert. Thanks for listening to another episode of my show. For more live music podcasting, check out our other show, Jam Journals. If you're feeling kind, give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and check us out on all the social media platforms. Email us at info@yesterdaysconcert.com or visit our website, yesterdaysconcert.com. So until next time, give us a subscribe, tell your friends, and most importantly, take care of your shoes.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.